This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Minority children wait longer to be adopted than white kids. In 1994, Congress enacted the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act to take a colorblind approach and make it easier for white couples to adopt minority children. Under the law, foster and adoptive parents cannot request children of a specific race, and agencies may not consider race in the placement process. Placement for African-American kids has gone up, but they still wait longer than whites. A report released today asserts that the status quo is not working, that a child-centered approach demands that race be considered as one factor in the process. For one thing, white parents need to be trained to address issues of racial and cultural identity, what to tell their kids, for example, about what to do if they're followed by security in the mall. We'll speak with the editor of the study and with a critic in just a moment. Later in the hour, psychologists use video game technology as a tool to help troops back from Iraq with PTSD. But first, we'd like to hear from listeners with personal experience of multiracial adoption, whether you raised a child of a different race or whether you were adopted. Tell us your story. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Adam Pertman, Executive Director of the Adoption Institute and editor of the new study. He's with us from our bureau in New York. And thanks very much for coming in today.
Thanks for asking me.
And if the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act has increased adoption rates for minority children over the past 10 years or so, why do you think it needs to be changed?
Well, it's important to say that it's increased the rate very, very little, a couple percentage points at best. And it's not clear that it's the only reason why the number of adoptions of black kids by white parents has increased. So that's important to say. Second, we simply haven't done a good enough job. When we see a law that's been in effect for a dozen years and we don't see anything, I was going to say dramatic, but even substantial as a change, as a positive change, then I think it's fair to say, let's take a look at it. Let's see if there's a better way to do it. And that's the role that the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute played. We're a research and policy organization. We didn't have a horse in this race, so to speak. We don't place kids or anything. We wanted to see what's working, what's not. And what we discovered is that we could probably do this better.
What's the scale of the problem in your mind?
Well, the disproportionality, as it's called, of the disproportionate number of African-American kids in foster care remains as significant as it was when this law was implemented. Roughly 15% of the children in America are African-American, but the number, the percentage of children in foster care, black kids in foster care, is double that. It's really disproportionate, and the law doesn't seem to have made much of an impact on that.
So when we talk about the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, we're really talking about white couples and African-American kids.
That's right. It was the law was intended, and it's important to say that it's the successor to MEPA a couple years after it was implemented, that was an amendment to MEPA that really imposed the colorblind standard. It took away – MEPA allowed race to be a consideration, not the consideration, but a consideration. And the follow-on amendments said not even a consideration.
And that's what you want to go back to, is more or less the original act.
That's right. I mean, we're very careful to say interracial families are just fine, and we know they're working all over America. In fact, there are many, many more now than there were a dozen years ago. But we also know much more now, and we're in a different place culturally now, where we really believe that the professionals in the field are capable of making reasoned judgment, taking race into account, not using it as the primary factor, but saying that a white parent adopting a white kid might need to know a few things.
Such as?
Oh, such as the example that you cited. How do you answer your child's question when he says, the security of the mall seems to be following me? The more general answer, because I think intuitively we really understand that we don't yet live in a colorblind society. I think anybody, I'm not sure how many examples to give, but certainly anybody covering the presidential race knows that we're not yet in a colorblind society. But in general, there are lots of things that kids of color, almost any kid of color, whether they think this is a good idea or bad idea to train their parents, will not tell their parents. You know, the indignities that they suffer, the slurs they hear, the getting followed, they're not all, by the way, racist issues. Some of them are just racial issues, and they're things that kids encounter as a matter of course. and don't think twice about but might be negative. There are identity formation issues that we cover in this study that it would be nice if adoptive parents knew existed so that they could help their kids through them. So it's a gamut of issues and challenges, but it's not all negative or racist by any means.
We're going to continue talking with Adam Pertman, and in just a moment we'll also hear from one of his critics, but we also want to hear from those who've been through this experience, either as parents or as kids. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Jim's on the line. Jim calling us from Pemberville, Ohio.
Yes.
Hi, Jim.
Hello. My wife and I adopted a biracial boy when he was 2 months old, and now he's 13. And we've gone through some of those issues of identity, and we're still going through them. We originally adopted him when we lived in a rather large city and worked in the inner city and lived in the inner city. And then because of gang activity and some other really negative things in the neighborhood that we were living in, we moved to a smaller town. And that has proved to be, you know, challenging and kind of unique in the way that we've raised him.
So he's now more of a minority? There are fewer African-Americans around?
Yes. The town has, I think there's probably five or six African-Americans. In fact, we went to dinner the other night, and two people were there, two African-Americans that we hadn't seen before that just moved into town. And Nate goes, gosh, I thought there was only like four or five of us.
Interesting. Do you think that you could have benefited from training from counselors as to some of the problems you might be facing down the road?
I think we could have. My wife is a teacher, and I'm a pastor. And like I said, we both have worked in the inner city until we moved up here all of our lives. So we kind of had a handle on a lot of that stuff. But it's different, I think, when it's your own child. It's really an interesting experience when your child asks you questions like that, as opposed to students in the classroom or people where you work.
Should race have been used as a factor in the adoption, do you think?
I don't think so. It's hard to say that now because we love him so much that, you know, I can't imagine not being with him, not having him in our family. I would hate to think that that would have been a race, but who knows? You know, we did have to say we adopted him from a Catholic social service agency, and we did have to say that we would raise him with awareness of his cultural and racial identity, which we have done. We've got him in a private school that's more racially diverse than the town in which we live. And so we've done a lot of that, and because of who we are, we've taken him to different, you know, things in Toledo that we can go to, and we have developed friendships cross-racially. So we've done some of that, but I think it would have been helpful at the beginning to have a little bit more of that.
Well, right, and if I may, the report does not in any way say that people like this should not adopt those kids. They're simply saying that if they do, there might be some things you want to know.
And you got at least some that one question there because it was Catholic services and presumably doesn't get federal funding, so they didn't come under MEPA.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks very much, Jim, and good luck to you and to your son.
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate the phone call. Joining us now from the studios at the Harvard University Office of News and Public Affairs is Elizabeth Barthollet. She is the Morris Wasserstein Public Interest Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Child Advocacy Program at Harvard Law School. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And so, go ahead.
Can I say a word? I feel as if your listeners are getting the wrong idea about MEPA, because MEPA completely allows training and socialization of prospective parents. What MEPA forbids is separating out prospective transracial parents and giving them pass-fail tests based on things that I think Jim's comments show would be so problematic. So MEPA prevents failing the prospective transracial parent because they don't necessarily give you the perfect politically correct, yes, we'll live in Center City. No, we won't move to the small town because of gang activity. There is lots of racial sensitivity training now going on under MEPA. MEPA says it is true that race cannot be used as a factor in screening out Jim and saying because he's the wrong race or gives the politically incorrect answer. answers, he can't have the particular child. And in terms of why that's so important, I think it's important to know that it wasn't just between 94 and 96 when MIPA 1, the first version, said that race could be a factor. It wasn't just for those 2 years that race was used as a factor and supposedly only a factor. For 20 years, that had been the constitutional rule in this country that race could be used but only as one factor. And in the name of that rule, there was systematic, rigid race matching with black kids being kept in foster care till they grew out of it very often. The reason that Metzenbaum came back out of retirement in 1996 to pass the amendments to MIPA, which is what Adam Pertman's group wants to get rid of, the reason Metzenbaum came back is he saw that the 94 version of MIPA, which continued to allow race to be used as a factor but only one factor, was not going to work, that we were still getting rigid race matching. And that is, I completely believe, what we would get if anybody in Congress was ever so foolish as to think that we should once again amend MIPA and allow race to, quote, be a factor. The social workers will use it systematically to rule out transracial adoption or to insist that Jim, you know, sell his house and move back into the center city if he wants a second child.
You're talking about Howard Metzenbaum, the Democratic senator from Ohio.
Yes, who
came back out of retirement.
But let me
just ask a question. According to today's New York Times, in 2003, social workers in Ohio were accused of discriminating against a white couple by requiring them to prepare a plan to address the child's cultural needs and to evaluate the racial demographics of their neighborhood. The state then paid $1.8 million in fines. Isn't that the kind of thing
I
that
would
Jim
love
was asked
you
to sign?
I would love you and all the press and all your listeners to read the 2003 HHS decision. What it shows is that something like 19 different kids in foster care with disabilities who were black, who finally, social workers had found a parent, a transracial parent, ready to take them with their disabilities. Those kids were instead kept in foster care because those parents, it wasn't because they refused to go through training. It was because when they went through the kind of, quote, training that Adam wants to impose again, they answered, quote, wrong. They lived in the wrong neighborhood. They didn't go to the right black church. And it was because of their, quote, wrong, politically incorrect answers that the children were kept in foster care, delayed for months, and if they were at all placed eventually. And that's what that decision says.
More with Elizabeth Bartholet and Adam Pertman. We're talking about transracial adoption. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For years, debate raged over whether children of color should be placed only with parents of the same race. A federal law enacted in 1994 required a colorblind approach, and a new report suggests that race now be reinstituted as one factor in the process. We're talking with Adam Pertman, executive director of the Adoption Institute. He's the co-editor of the report. And with Elizabeth Bartholet, the director of the Child Advocacy Program at Harvard Law School. We want to know what your experience has been if you raised a child of a different race or if you were adopted yourself. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you can read what some other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Kathy. Kathy with us from Kansas City in Kansas.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Yes. I'm actually originally from Portland, Oregon, which is where I was adopted. And I can't prove this, but I've been told that I was the 11th biracial adoption in the nation, and it was in 1957. So, you know, I almost felt like, is my story even relevant? But I do feel as though I'm a trailblazer.
And certainly predates this federal law.
Right, exactly, which may, you know, give me a lot to think about. What they tried to discourage my parents. You know, the adoption agency poo-pooed her, my mother, and said, surely, you know, you don't want it. The story goes that my mom and dad couldn't have another child. They had two daughters already, and they wanted another daughter. So they went in to the agency, and the agency sort of looked at them. I have this picture in my mind of this, you know, really uptight old woman saying, you don't want her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she did say. You wouldn't be interested. And my mother said, well, why? And they said, well, she's colored. And my mother said, is she a girl? And that's the kind of person my mom and my father my mother was and my father is.
And it sounds from the smile in your voice that things worked out pretty well.
I thank God for them. I know that I don't know what my life would have been like if someone who loved me had not taken me to their home and made me one of their family.
That's a great story, Kathy. And I wonder, as you think back now on your experience and put yourself in the place of the kids now in foster care, how would you want it to be handled?
I see both parts. I think that race can be an issue because I have seen children who were raised by white people. I hate to say this, but truly were raised by white people who they tried to make white children. They tried to turn them white, and turn against sort of like their own. They didn't introduce them to their culture and make them proud of that. That's very rare. I think the bottom line is every child needs a family, needs a home, and in all cases, it doesn't matter what color those people are. They will love them, and that's what every child needs.
Kathy, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
And her point, Adam Pertman, is if there are barriers that keep kids from families and keep them in foster care, shouldn't those barriers go down?
Absolutely, and nothing in our paper, Betsy's comments notwithstanding, mandates that anybody wants to impose anything on anyone. We very clearly say that our priority is the kids. We want more kids to get placed in more homes. Some will be transracial, some will not be, but the number of kids of African American kids in particular who remain in foster care is unacceptable. And I want to just address a couple of the other points. In terms of training, Professor Bartholet says that there are training programs all over the country. We know from the ground that there's a chilling effect of these lawsuits and these fines that were imposed in two states. And that is precisely why we are researchers. But the people on the ground who care for children and families for a living, the North American Council on Adoptable Children, the Child Welfare League of America, the National Association of Black Social Workers, Voice for Adoption, Foster Care Alumni, National Association of Social Workers, and on, they endorse this work. They are not interested in imposing anything on anyone. I reject the notion that they're going to use a change in law to, quote, impose single-race adoptions. I have more respect for them for that. And we know from practice every day that they do it more and more. So we don't live in the same place we did a dozen years ago. This is a factor. And we do trust that the people on the ground will do a responsible job and get more kids homes.
Elizabeth Bartholet.
Yeah, I'd just like to take on this notion that it's a pure research and policy organization that Adam is talking for and that these organizations that have supported his report are pure policy, no horse in the race. Those of us in the adoption field think of the Donaldson Institute not as a research organization, and they did no new research for this. They read the same reports I have read. It's an advocacy organization. And when he mentions one of the organizations that has endorsed it that we can trust to do race matching appropriately or race factor use, Black Social Workers Association is the organization that came out in 1973 when a fair amount of transracial adoption was going on, and the Black Social Workers Association said that it would be better for every black child to stay in black foster care until they matured out of it rather than that they go into a transracial adoptive home. So this is an
advocacy. That was some time ago.
They take
a very similar position today.
Well, how about the...
Adam Pertman, let Professor Bartholet talk, and we'll get back to you.
I just want to say once again that it is true that when race has been allowed to be used as a factor but wasn't supposed to be a systematically used factor, it has regularly operated as a factor that delayed the adoption of kids out of foster care. So that's why MEPA had to be passed in the first place. All MEPA tries to do is get rid of the barrier that prevents black kids from getting homes. The reason we need the transracial placements is because more than half the kids in foster care are kids of color. And despite the fact that black families are adopting at even higher rates than white families, there have not been enough of them. And common sense can tell you that if you get rid of race as a barrier, it's likely to work. The reason when he says, well, MEPA's been around since 96 and it hasn't made all the difference, the first enforcement decision, HHS wasn't that enthusiastic about enforcing it in the beginning. The first enforcement decision was the 2003 Ohio decision. So I think we can see it having a lot more impact now that HHS has begun to enforce it.
All right, Adam, and then we're going to get some more callers on the line.
Sure. I can only disagree on almost all the merits and the name calling about the Adoption Institute. But I think that, simply put, the numbers don't bear out what Professor Bartholet is suggesting. And if the numbers don't bear it out, and if we're not doing diligent recruitment of families that can adopt these kids, then we're not doing the best job we can for them.
Let's talk with Al, and Al's with us from Elkhart in Indiana.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Well, my wife and I, we have six children we've adopted, ranging from ages 13 down to 2.5. Four are African-American, two are biracial. We fostered over 70 through our home. We're in our mid-50s. Of those 70, probably 80% of them were African-American or biracial children. When we got into the foster program 10, 15 years ago, from the inside out, we saw that the greater need was for foster families in the African-American or black culture, because it wasn't so much that there was that many more kids, but there was a shortage of foster parents. And so we stepped into that and invited them in their home. With that, we had to dig in and do some learning about skin care, hair care, a lot of cultural things that we didn't realize when we started. And then we've since then helped educate other foster parents, white foster parents mainly, in the same thing. And we've put a lot of bridges between us and the African-American community in doing this. And even to this day, we're still involved a little bit with the foster programs. There's still a great shortage of good foster homes, and especially with the African-American community.
And how is the experience working out, do you think, from the point of view of the kids, Al?
I think it's working great. Everybody sees our family, they just love us as a unit. And we have like I say, we don't really, our kids are real sensitive. They don't like to be called black because they know what the color of black looks like. And they're brown-skinned, and they call other people brown-skinned. But even among us, we all lay our arms together, and the shade variance is beautiful. And we found that most of the kids, they are taught color and taught a racism-type thing. To them, like the one reader, I was so thrilled to hear the first caller there talk about she'd been adopted and how they just loved on her. And we feel that our children feel the same thing. They just want somebody to love them and bring them to home and give them a safe place to grow up. And like she also said, we're very sensitive that we're not trying to raise them as white children, that we embrace their culture, and it's really good for us, too, to step into that. And it puts us many times, my wife and I, as a minority in some of the things we step into. So we get to experience a little of that other side of it, too. So
it's not a simple issue, is it?
No, it's not. But it is an issue that there are children out there languishing in the system, and I dare say there's children out there that need to be in the system that aren't because there are no good placement to put them into. In fact, we know that as we've been experiencing that there's some that almost turn a blind eye because of just nothing doing it. It's sad to say that, but it's true.
Al, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Bartholet, let me ask you, if that disproportion that existed in the first place still largely exists, if black kids are twice as many in foster care as there are in the population at large, if MEPA has not addressed that, shouldn't it be changed? Shouldn't we consider a tweak?
His tweak will make it worse. In other words, what MEPA does is to try to reduce one of the reasons, a major reason, that social workers might say no to the placement of a black child out of foster care. MEPA says, you know, that social worker cannot refuse the transracial parents that are there ready to take the kid home simply because they're the wrong color or they answered the question wrong. So, you know, MEPA is working. It's hopefully along with other forces like the Adoption and Safe Families Act to get these kids out of foster care. If you got Adam Pertman's amendment, you'd have another reason to lock yet more kids into foster care. So, could MEPA work better? Yes. But again, I'm saying that the first enforcement decision didn't come till 2003. I mean, I spent many years traveling the country giving talks about why isn't HHS enforcing MEPA. So I saw them as not doing anything to enforce MEPA. They're finally enforcing it. This would be a lunatic time to say, well, now let's change the law to make it weaker because they didn't enforce it, you know, early on. I mean, it's only going to help the law as it is. And I just want to make one comment on your recent caller's comments. I mean, I would see, by virtue of the things that Al, who sounds like a wonderful foster and adoptive parent to me, that I would just say to you, I think he might have been might be screened out under Adam Pertman's new regime because he said his children actually call themselves brown, not black. Now, that is the kind of thing that in some of the kinds of studies that Adam Pertman has cited in his report gets counted as poor self-esteem. Look, this transracial child calls himself brown or biracial rather than black. That's a sign of, quote, problems. I mean, the only studies of transracial adoptees that have come up with any problems are, you know, it's those kinds of problems that get cited because this isn't supposed to be the way the social worker thinks you should talk. It doesn't show adequate identification with the black community. If you take a fair look at the research that the Pertman Institute reports talks about, a fair look at the research, and many people other than I have summarized it this way, shows that overwhelmingly the good controlled sample studies show no harm whatsoever in self-esteem or other terms coming to kids placed transracially. Lots of harm coming to kids who are held for any extra time in foster care. So, you know, yes, I want to see more kids get placed out of foster care. That's why we need to keep MEPA as it is.
We're talking with Elizabeth Bartholet and Adam Pertman about transracial adoption, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Andrea. Andrea with us from Raleigh in North Carolina.
Hello. I have a question about when we talk about transracial adoptions, we're always talking about white families adopting black kids. And I know the obvious answer is that there are more black kids in the system than there are white kids, but I don't understand why there are no black families adopting white kids. I grew up in, I'm multiracial. I grew up in a family with two white parents. I was adopted by my father. We adopted a girl who was black, and I feel like I was raised in the white culture. And if I adopted, which I would like to adopt, I would probably prefer to adopt a white child because I would feel more of a cultural connection to that child. But I know that that wouldn't be possible. We look at white people going over to Africa and adopting black kids. Well, how come Africans don't come over here and adopt white kids?
Adam Pertman?
All I can say is that it's a great question. It does happen, by the way, that African-Americans adopt white kids. It certainly does not happen often. I need to take the moment to say that my amendment and my imposition and what I want to do is really immaterial, and they're not mine. I agree with Professor Bartholet unequivocally that our aim should be to help more of these kids get into families, multiracial families, single-race families, into families, because being in temporary care is not good for anybody, and interracial adoptions are a solution to that unequivocally. We're not talking about imposing tests. We're not talking about failing anybody. We are talking about expanding the pool and educating the parents so they can do a better job of raising their children. I urge people to read the report and judge for themselves.
Andrea, thanks very much for the call. Here's an email that we have from Linda in Rochester, New York. My white parents adopted two African-American sisters who were 5 and 7 years old in the mid-70s. We lived in a white middle-class neighborhood, and our next-door neighbors in St. Albans, West Virginia, actually built a fence between our houses because of it. I was 16 years old and was ostracized by some of my peers, including my boyfriend at the time. It was devastating to me, and my family was totally unprepared for the whole thing. It did not work out particularly well, so I believe the more people can be prepared, the more likely the process is to be beneficial to all concerned. And I guess, Elizabeth Bartholet, that might be an argument for including race as one factor.
No. It would be an argument for doing more of what is completely allowed and encouraged now under MEPA, which is educating prospective parents, transracial but also same race, about all these issues. I totally believe in education. That is allowed under MEPA current law. When Adam Pertman says we want to go back to MEPA 1, what MEPA 1, the 94 version he wants to go back to, allowed was racial sensitivity screening a pass-fail test, and if you don't give the right answers, you get failed. And when his report criticizes the 2003 decision, what was found illegal in the 2003 decision was not training prospective parents. It was screening them out because they answered the questions in a way that the social worker thought was wrong.
I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there, but thank you both for your time today. We appreciate it. Obviously, this debate will go on. Elizabeth Bartlett, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Elizabeth Bartlett is the Morris Wasserstein Public Interest Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Child Advocacy Program at Harvard Law School. And our thanks to Adam Pertman as well, the Executive Director of the Adoption Institute. He was with us from our bureau in New York. Adam Pertman, thank you very much.
Thank you. And it's the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute, just so people can find it on the web.
Okay. Thanks very much for the correction. Coming up, using simulation to treat Iraq veterans with PTSD, virtual Iraq, and your letters. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.